Eveen and Company with Eveen Ihuluwan on RTE Radio 1.
Good morning. This is a particularly special time of the year for everyone who recently sat the Leaving Cert. The exams are long over and now the quiet countdown is beginning to the exam results and to all of the big decisions to be made by these students about their future. For tens of thousands of students, that future includes an education at one of the universities around the country. So I am very pleased to welcome Professor Patrick Prendergast, the Provost of Trinity College Dublin, to studio. As leader of that university, he plays an influential role in Irish education, in the life of the university and the city of Dublin. And I have to declare my own interest here because I'm a postgraduate student at Trinity and this is my first time to meet him, and that makes me doubly pleased to spend some time in his company. Paddy, you're very welcome.
Good to be here.
Provost is a very old-fashioned title. First of all, can you explain to me what a provost is?
Well, the provost in Trinity College is the head of the university, equivalent to president in other institutions. Our vice-chancellor is often used in universities abroad, or in Europe the word rector is often used. That's the boss, basically.
And why doesn't Trinity then use the term of president, or maybe like an organisation use chief executive? Or
well, I suppose the statutes in 1592 called the head of the university the provost, and we've stuck with that title ever since. I think it's a good title. I think I like to use it.
And there's some lovely traditions associated with the job, including a residence on campus. Can you describe the home that comes with the position of provost?
Many people who live in Dublin actually don't realise it's there. But if you stand at the Molly Malone statue and look over towards Trinity College, in behind the walls and the railings is a Palladian mansion. And that's where the provost of Trinity College Dublin must live. My contract says I must reside in number 1 Grafton Street for the 10 years of the provostship, which of course it's a privilege for me to do and I'm very glad to do. And my family loves living there.
And is it an urban myth that you've got a fantastic wine cellar as part of being the provost?
There's a lot of talk about this wine cellar. It wouldn't be much of an urban myth if I told you the truth of the matter. But there would be room for a good cellar if I wanted to stock one.
Very good. And you've mentioned your children, Paddy. They were photographed recently with the Obama children on their visit to Dublin. So how are they coping with the public aspect of your role?
I think they love it, actually. And they were very pleased to meet the Obama girls. Emer and Eilish are my two eldest, and they're the same ages as the Obama girls. So that was nice to do. They're mostly in the background. Although my son Pierce does get out on his bike and cycle around the college and looks on it, I think, a bit like his backyard.
Well, that's some playground to have in the back garden. Just going back to the provost title and the election, it's almost as old-fashioned as, you know, the Vatican selecting a pope. Can you explain to me how the election system works?
All staff that have a vote assemble in a large hall and the door is locked. Those that want to be provost have had their names declared previously and the voting begins. And ballot papers are handed out and people put an X beside the name they want. And whoever gets the least number of votes is eliminated and a totally fresh ballot is held. So it's not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or 6 in the order of your choice. It's multiple ballots. And that's why it takes so long. So there's a lot of counting going on. And between ballots might take 1 or 2 hours to count all these votes and recheck them. So there's canvassing going on in the hall and nobody can leave until the thing is all over. So as you can imagine, we're all there for 4 or 5 hours by the time it gets to the final ballot.
Is this all of the staff in Trinity?
All of the staff that have a vote, about, I suppose, 800 staff and student representatives.
How was it announced that you were the winner? Was it down to two people at the end of it?
It was, yeah. Now, there's an unwritten rule, I suppose, that we don't talk about, you know, who came where in the various different votes. But yes, it's down to two people in the end. It's great tension. You could cut the tension with a knife. I think the people who were there, certainly the candidates, but I think all the electors as well, will never forget the tension. And at the end, the head of the count whispered to me that I had won. And he was going up to announce the final vote.
And what was going through your mind when you were chosen?
Well, I suppose the responsibilities that were coming onto my shoulders with this job. I mean, it's Ireland's leading university. I was elected on a particular manifesto of leading this university. And the challenge that came onto my shoulders for doing that for the next 10 years, I felt that very strongly at the time. And I suppose the honour that had been conferred on me through the election process and how I was going to have the challenge of facing up to that in the coming years.
Because you're an engineer by trade, Paddy, but going into the administration of university is very different. So when did you decide that you wanted to try and be provost?
Well, I didn't come into Trinity in 1995 as a lecturer thinking I'm going to become provost. I really didn't really know what the provost was then, actually. But sometime later in 2004, my predecessor, John Hegarty, asked me to become a dean of graduate studies. And when I took that on, I thought, well, this will be interesting. I'll do it for a few years and see how it goes, and then I'll go back to my research. But sometime after that, in 2008, John Hegarty asked me to be vice provost, which is the number two in the college administration. If I was going to be vice provost, I would certainly be in pole position to run for provost when his term would come to an end. So I suppose that's when I decided that it was time to get serious about this.
And during the election, a professor of psychology asked all of the candidates a very relevant question: do you want power? How did you answer that one?
Well, he asked us all this question at a hustings, actually, Professor Ian Robertson. And I think we all gave the wrong answer, because we all said, you know, we want to serve the community, we look forward to working with our colleagues and so on. That's more or less the kind of answer we all gave. But he said that that's wrong, actually. You have to like the power that comes with the job. If you don't like the power, if you don't like, in a way, exerting the legitimate authority that comes with a leadership position, then you won't be able to do the job effectively. And I think that I've had cause to reflect on that since then, really. And I think it's true in any position of leadership. A person, I suppose, has to get a kick out of it, out of making the decisions that come with it, because sometimes the decisions are difficult and can create a lot of stress. And if you're not comfortable with decision making, if you don't, you know, get some inner satisfaction, I suppose, out of it, then I think you'll find it difficult to make the decisions, and you'll find it difficult to execute a leadership role effectively.
And is there politics in your blood then, Paddy?
Well, none of my family have ever been elected politicians, so I don't think there's politics in the blood. My father had a role once as a president of the Irish Road Haulage Association, which I expect, although I didn't know it at the time, but I expect it involved quite a lot of the kind of politicking that that you have to do to come to a leadership role in an organisation. Mm-hmm. But I don't think explicit politicking, what happens in politics with a big P, is my cup of tea.
What's the satisfaction in the leadership role that you're in then?
Well, I think the satisfaction is, of course, leading an organisation, an institution like Trinity that exists for 420 years. The satisfaction comes from doing one's best to ensure that that organisation continues to succeed, continues to contribute effectively to Irish society, and continues to be an exemplar, in a way, of what Irish people can do when they work together effectively. Because Trinity College is an organisation that has a worldwide reputation, an organisation that plays for Ireland on the world stage, if you like, and is well known. And it's a great challenge and sense of satisfaction that comes from ensuring that that continues into the future.
Mm-hmm. And you yourself studied as an undergraduate in Trinity. Can you take me back to that first day in October 1983 when you went to Trinity? Because this will lead us to our first piece of music, which is Dexy's Midnight Runners.
I went to St. Peter's College, Wexford, and from there I came to Trinity College, Dublin. My careers guidance teacher, Mr. Philip O'Sullivan, recommended that I come to Trinity College to study engineering. He recommended many others to go to UCD and UCC, but me to come to Trinity, and I've never really figured out why. But it was a good choice. And when I came up to Dublin, in fact, I stayed with my aunt in Cabinteely for the first couple of months. I remember my parents driving me up. They were in the front and I was in the back seat, and they had the tea with my aunt, and then we're going down home, and I asked my father, you know, how do I get into Trinity? And he said, I don't know. Get the bus, I suppose. So I got the 45 bus the next morning and asked somebody how to get to Trinity. And that's I remember it was a newspaper seller at the corner of where the Screen Cinema is. And she pointed me to the green railings. They were painted green then. And she said, follow that around to the front. And that's Trinity College. And that's exactly what I did. And I looked in the front gate and I said, my God, this is really big, this place. And I went in the front arch and out into Front Square. And the rest is history.
Every time I walk in there, I'm just flabbergasted by it. So how did that make you feel?
Well, it gives you an adrenaline rush, I suppose, because there's so much going on in Front Square in that week. This is Freshers Week. So all the student clubs and societies have their stalls set out. So there's so much going on, and you think, my God, I've come to this this wonderful place, and it's so cosmopolitan, and there's so much, so many interesting things to do. It was great. I thought, well, this is it. I've really arrived now.
And for all of the tens of thousands of young people who are going to be going to college for the first time this autumn, is there any particular advice you'd give them?
Well, it's important to be doing a course that you enjoy, because if you enjoy it, you'll be good at it. It's absolutely key to focus on your academic studies, but also take the time to meet people outside your own department or discipline of study or field of study. Your university years are important times to develop your social network as well.
Mm-hmm.
I would say for people who are coming up from the country like I did, stay in contact with home. You know, keep your parents involved. When young people go to university, it's absolutely right that they become very independent. But it's also important to keep contact with family and friends back home, because they're one of the important rocks that you have in your life as it goes on.
Good advice there. So why did you choose Come On Eileen, that song?
Well, this was the song that was number one in the UK charts, I think, when I came to Trinity in 1983. It was played non-stop. All the student parties we went to during that Freshers' Week, and in first year, this was the one that was played time and time again, so that's why I chose it.
Can I say to you that I didn't want to go to Trinity because I thought it was too posh and too snobby. So I went off to UCD and I had a great time doing my degree there. Mm. But do you think that some people hold that notion of Trinity, that it's too archaic?
I think unfortunately some people do. They think Trinity is full of snobs. But I can tell you it is absolutely not the case, neither among the students nor the staff. Trinity is very diverse. Trinity draws its students from all 32 counties in Ireland and from 130 countries worldwide. What matters in Trinity really is not your social background, but how smart you are, your commitment to your work, your ability to interact with others and to be a bit radical and a bit pushy. And that's the kind of student that we want to see in Trinity. But it's not anyway correlated with people's perceived notions of snobbiness.
I want to talk first of all about the financial element, because I know there'll be a lot of parents listening and, you know, wondering about how they're going to pay for their sons and daughters to go to college in, you know, in the autumn. So first of all, can you explain to parents and students why you think they might have to end up paying more for their university education?
Well, firstly, all educational institutions have to be adequately funded if they're there to continue to deliver quality education. Now, it seems to me that the ability to raise taxes to pay for higher education is reducing. The funding that comes from government to higher education institutions is reducing. Only 50% now of the funding that Trinity College would get is Exchequer funding, and 50% is non-Exchequer funding.
So you're getting 50% from the government and 50% from private funding?
From private sources, either postgraduate students paying their fees or students from outside the European Union paying fees, or commercial activities that the university engages in, or philanthropy, or industry research contracts as well. Mm-hmm. That would account for 50% of the total budget of the university. And I expect that will increase beyond 50% in the coming years. So what we're seeing is a reduced investment, I suppose, from the public purse into higher education institutions. And it's the same for all higher education institutions in the country.
Should it be the responsibility of government to pay for university education? Is it a public endeavour?
Well, I think university education is a public good. Society benefits from having doctors and nurses and engineers and entrepreneurs and so on. So it is right that the state subsidises what universities do. But it's also a private benefit. A university degree also confers a private good on an individual, allowing them to earn a better salary, perhaps, and have a happier life in the long run, a more satisfying career and a happier life. So it's a mix of a public good and a private good. So really, funding a university education should be a mix of private and public funding. Now, when it comes to what individual students pay, the tuition fee for the students is actually paid in Ireland. Undergraduate students, it's paid by the state, so-called free fees.
Mm-hmm. But it's not really free. I mean, you're paying €2,000, €2,500.
Yeah, but that's a very small proportion of the total cost. So if we're talking about the balance that I referred to, a balance between a public good and a private good, You could say that that balance is not properly struck at the moment, and that the individual that benefits from it could pay more. Many countries do this through student loan systems or graduate taxation systems. In Ireland, we haven't really faced up to the fact that we need to increase the amount of private funding from individuals into universities. There are many, I suspect, maybe not many, but there's a good proportion that could well afford to pay the tuition fee themselves or their parents to pay. And that would seem rational that they would pay if mm-hmm. they can afford to pay.
So do you foresee that the structure will have to change in the next couple of years? Like, it won't happen immediately, I presume.
But well, either the structure changes or the quality of what we offer goes down. And we'll find that more of our young people will choose to go to universities abroad, in the UK, in the US, where the quality of higher education provision is higher than what we're able to offer in Ireland. That's what will happen if we continue on to both reduce public funding and stop universities from charging fees. That's the inevitable consequence.
So would you prefer then that either government removes itself from that funding so that you have more control over it, or what do you see as the best way forward?
I think we need to face up the fact that some people can afford, and it would be appropriate for them to pay fees. And then there should be some ramped system so that those on very high incomes pay a fee and those on very low incomes pay no fee and those in median incomes pay a proportion of the total cost of the mm-hmm. education. And I think some loan system should be in place to allow students to borrow if they can't afford to pay. Many countries have developed this system to finance higher education. And I believe we should address that kind of system here as well. But we have to understand what the consequences is if we don't. The consequence is, if we don't, that the quality of our universities will reduce. Mm-hmm. And I mean, a low quality higher education is no good to anybody. The ratio of students to staff is about, in many Irish universities, more than 20 students per staff member. Now, that's way out of kilter with international norms. Most universities in the UK would have maybe 15, maybe even 12 students per staff member. So we're out of kilter and we haven't got sufficient academic staff for the number of students that we have. And this in the context of government's targets, which are right in a way, to increase the number of students going into higher education, increase both the percentage of school leavers going into higher education. And we know that the number of school leavers is going to increase in the coming decades. So how are we going to address this increased demand for higher education whilst we know that the public coffers are under severe pressure? Mm-hmm. Something's going to have to give somewhere, and we haven't figured this out yet.
So we do need more academics to be working in our universities.
I absolutely think we do. We need to expand our universities, and not what we're doing at the moment under various, the austerity measures. We're contracting the size of our universities by reducing the number of lecturers we have in them.
But you've got other strategies for funding, because philanthropy is now an important part of Trinity College Dublin.
Philanthropy is important, and it's becoming increasingly important to all Irish universities. In fact, it has always been important, and great philanthropists like Chuck Feeney and Atlantic Philanthropies have put tens of millions, hundreds of millions into Irish universities to expand them and to help improve quality. The important thing, though, to, I think, understand is that many generous people are prepared to put money into universities, but only to propel them towards excellence. They're not going to put money into universities to shore up the funding that's missing from government or individual sources. Excellence is what many philanthropists are after, and they're right to look for excellence. For example, Martin Nocton recently funded our Centre for Nanotechnology, the Nocton Institute. And this is great. We've been able to attract some top academics from around the world and brilliant students to study, work and do research in the Nocton Institute. But the idea there was to create something in Ireland, a research institute that was excellent by world standards. It wasn't to shore it up to some median level. So a healthy financed university system is a combination of good public funding, good private funding from the individuals that benefit, plus philanthropy driving excellence in certain areas.
Do you think it would be possible and beneficial for the university to just be purely privately funded?
Well, you've asked me a very difficult question, one which I'm happy to try and answer. I've asked myself that question many times. The best universities in the world, the highest ranked universities, are the private ones, the Harvards, the Yales, the Stanfords. Clearly, the flexibility that comes with being a private university is part and parcel of what can generate great excellence. And I think it's important also to note that these private universities contribute greatly to the public good. They're universities that are world-renowned for the quality of their research and the education that they provide for their students. Could Trinity emulate that? I absolutely believe it could. However, it's not really the Irish or the European model to have solely private universities. Now, there are some private institutions here in Dublin City, for example. Griffith College is private and does very well. And it's growing, whereas the public universities are contracting in the number of academic staff they employ. Some of the private institutions, such as Griffith College, can expand to meet demand. Mm-hmm. So the flexibility is given to private universities allow them to meet the contemporary challenges of globalisation more head-on. I think that we should be more flexible about how Irish universities are run, and perhaps there can be elements of how private organisations work that can be incorporated into how universities that are public bodies work. So I wouldn't see it as just a bimodal, either private or public, or nothing in between. There are universities around the world that combine both the private and the public model very effectively, and maybe that might be the kind of environment that Irish universities could prosper in and be truly globally competitive, particularly in the context of decreasing ability of public funds to fund universities.
Is it something that might be difficult, though, because we don't have that history of philanthropy in Ireland? We don't have that history of, if you graduated from somewhere, that you kind of invest back into that university.
People say we don't have any history of philanthropy, but people give a lot to the church, for example. And they give a lot to certain church bodies over the generations. Hospitals, for example. People often give legacies to such organisations. There are certain Irish wealthy individuals now who have imbibed the philanthropy gene, if you like, because it's so current around the world. And many of these individuals are networked around the world. They run global businesses, so they see philanthropy operating effectively in other countries. And they want to see it work to the benefit of Irish society as well. So I wouldn't write off philanthropy. I think we're going down that road.
And if you were Minister for Education for a week, Paddy, what would you do?
Well, there's always a question that's a surprise. And that one is a surprise. a Minister for Education for a week. If I had Rory Quinn's job for a week, well, I suppose I would tackle the issue of fees and the fact that individuals should pay fees into Irish universities. I think that this needs to be addressed more directly than it is being addressed at the moment. Other things that the minister is doing, I quite agree with, such as his opening up the whole issue of admissions into higher education. He's been quite tough on this and saying that we need to make university admissions fairer. Mm-hmm. And remove roadblocks to admissions.
Well, a lot of people say about the CAO is that it is fair because it's a blanket exam and everyone has to go through the same pressure and it's completely anonymous. So what do you think we could do instead of the CAO system?
Well, the CAO system is certainly transparent. But whether it's fair or not is an interesting question. Personally, I don't think it is fair. I think it only measures one kind of ability, really. And this is because the Leaving Cert exam itself is an exam where rote learning is prioritised over other kinds of learning. Now, let's not say that rote learning is all bad. I mean, a little bit of rote learning is a good thing. Mm-hmm. But it prioritises the kind of intelligence that that works with rote learning. So we must find a way to examine students to take in other kinds of aptitudes other than rote learning aptitudes. And that's where I think the Leaving Cert falls down and why we need to consider alternative kinds of admissions. Very few countries, if any indeed, would admit solely based on one exam, mm-hmm. as we do here. One exam typically held over a couple of weeks when a student is 17 or 18, mm-hmm. and that determines their whole life. I think we need to use other contextual information when admitting students into universities. In the UK system, they use interviews. Now, I'm not suggesting we would do that here. That might be problematic in Ireland, but it goes to show that there are other methods. In Trinity too, we admit some students into courses based on auditions, for example, for music or for acting. So we have a history of using other methods than purely points-based systems, and I think we should expand that out more broadly.
And Trinity are piloting a scheme that's an alternative to the CAO.
Yes, next year we're going to admit students into a small number of students into some of our courses, law, for example, and history. using contextual data. For example, one of the elements of contextual data will be where the student is placed in their school. So if you're, if you come first in your school and get 500 points, that's an and you might come 20th in your school and get 500 points. Now, which student would you admit?
Obviously the first.
Well, that's the sort of contextual data that we think can be brought to bear on a fairer admission system.
Okay.
Admitting more broad aptitudes of talent into our universities. And Trinity is doing this feasibility study, rather, for the whole higher education sector. And we will share the results of this feasibility study with all other universities and institutes of technology.
Mm-hmm. That sounds very promising. So as Minister for Education, you're going to look at fees and you're going to look at admissions. Is there anything else that you would like to do for that week as a hypothetical Minister for Education?
Well, this sounds very much like telling Rory Quinn how to do his job. So I think since I don't... know what he would do where he provost, I won't presume to tell him any more about what he should do as Minister for Education.
Okay, well, Paddy, our next piece of music is from Josh Ritter and it's Bright Smile, and it's actually something that I imagine you don't get very much time to do, but when you go walking and relaxing, you like to listen to this. Why?
Because I don't have a commute from my address at number 1 Grafton Street into my office, so I sometimes walk up around St. Stephen's Green and listen to music like this. I don't particularly know why I like Josh Ritter. He appeals to something. Maybe I have a romantic streak.
Now my work is done, I feel I'm owed some joy. Imogene and Abelard, I'm your homeward boy. But there's another one that brings me to your door.
That was Bright Smile from Josh Ritter, chosen by Paddy, Provost of Trinity College Dublin. But before you were Provost, you had a career as a biomedical engineer. So can you explain to me the work and the research that you did?
The work I did was on the design and development of medical devices, all kinds of medical devices, orthopedic implants that people will be familiar with, such as hip implants and knee implants. I would have been involved in the design, development and testing of those kind of implants. Cardiovascular devices such as stents that are put into the arteries to open them when they're blocked. A revolutionary technology that's largely displaced bypass operations. Particularly what interested me was what we would call in silico simulation of these devices.
What does that mean?
Well, in silico means in the computer, in silicon rather than in the body. Now, you're a long way from ever needing any orthopaedic implants.
But if you did,
if you did, we might want to simulate how that implant would behave in your body, how long it would last, what would be the best design for you.
So it's computer programming with it.
Computer programming and simulation. That's particularly what I was interested in. Computer simulation of how these medical devices perform in the individual patient.
So that must be quite satisfying that your research is really having a direct impact on the health of people.
Yeah, and a lot of people do biomedical engineering for that reason. They want to help people. They want to help the sick. I must say, for me, it was really the challenge of the engineering problem rather than helping people. And maybe that sounds terrible now, but I really it was about the challenge of doing these computer simulations, I suppose, the intellectual challenge of it. Now, and that being said, the work we did was very beneficial to patients down the line. But the primary purpose for me, what gave me a thrill, was to be able to do these simulations that would match up with the clinical reality.
And tell me, what is that thrill when you have a problem that no one else has solved before and you're tackling it?
It's someone sort of described it once to me like when, and I think it's right, is when the circuit closes and some light comes on. And you say, God, I've discovered something that nobody in the world who has ever lived before has known. And that's great. There's a great, I get anyway, and I know that many other scientists and engineers do too, great thrill out of such discoveries. It's like coming over the top of a hill and seeing out into some new vista. And you say, God, that, I've done that and nobody else has. And that's what motivates a lot of people to continue to work at the frontier of science and engineering. Certainly motivated me, and I miss now as provost, not having that opportunity.
You don't get to research anymore as provost?
Yeah, you know, if you want to do research at the frontier of your discipline, you have to be going to conferences a lot, talking to people, writing grants to get the money for researchers to come and work with you on projects. It's very hard to get the time to do that and run a university as well.
Do you imagine that you'll return to it once your time as provost is over?
I'd like to imagine that, although things move quickly. And even talking to colleagues now in the last 2 years, medical device technology has moved on a lot. And I think it'll have moved on quite some distance in 10 years. So I might be able to get back into it, or I might not, but we'll see.
But Paddy, considering all of the contributions that you made in this research, you didn't really show much promise in your early years in secondary school, if you don't mind me saying that.
Well, I don't mind you saying it. I think you're referring to the fact that when I came to St. Peter's College, Wexford.
Yes, that they put you in one of the lower streams
they
for
did.
Some reason.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. There was A, B, C and D and I went into C. Yeah, so that was me categorised. But thankfully, that didn't define my academic career forever.
And I know we've already discussed the CAO system, but do you think that that's possibly another issue with it, that it is only examining one part, where obviously you're incredibly successful at solving problems? Maybe school and the way we're taught doesn't always encourage that.
Yeah, I think despite the valiant efforts of many teachers, of course, in the end of the day, students have to do well in this particular exam, the Leaving Cert. And then when it all boils down to it, the teachers have to teach the students to do well in this exam. And doing well in an exam is not the same as, you know, learning broadly. So we find that when students come into university, I'm sure other universities are the same, but many of us in Trinity would find that the students need a little bit of rehabilitation to get them into a learning mode that suits a university education after having gone through the Leaving Cert system.
Mm-hmm. Because we should really be learning to understand and learning to have independent thought rather than learning to how to get the best points in this exam.
Well, yeah, that's it. And I know students even learn off essays for the Leaving Cert. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's the point in that? That's rote learning at its extreme. And presumably there's some examiner there reading all these very same essays from some class. And because in the individual essay might be very good because it's been written by presumably a teacher, all these students get high marks. But when they come into university and then find that this is not an acceptable way to proceed, they have to learn for the first time, really, how to develop their critical thinking skills. And they have to see the value and priority that's placed on that in a university education, and indeed for later in life. I mean, the problems that they will solve or the work they will do when they start their careers, they won't have some teacher handing them the solution, and they just have to regurgitate it. So Irish society needs people who are creative, critical thinkers, innovators. In a way, sometimes people who are critics of the system. And university education is about developing those attributes, whereas getting into university is about developing the exact opposite, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Paddy, you had an opportunity as well to travel after your undergraduate degree.
Well, after my PhD, I did a stint in Bologna, and then I moved to the Netherlands and I worked in a city called Nijmegen. In a hospital there, again, an orthopaedic hospital. And I worked very closely with a man called Professor Rick Hauschkes. And I think he probably was the greatest single influence on my academic career. In Ireland in the early 1990s, when I did my PhD, there was a lot of good research being done, but there wasn't much in the way of equipment. It wasn't highly financed. It was completely the opposite in the Netherlands. This guy ran a lab with, you know, 3 or 4 postdocs and maybe 15 PhD students, big resources, tied into international networks. And that's where I really learned how top quality international science really works. So he taught me a lot, this guy, Rick Hauschkes.
And Paddy, did you set up a biomedical institute in Trinity?
I did. We set up, myself and colleagues in various other departments, the Trinity Centre for Bioengineering.
And was that following meeting this professor in the Netherlands?
Well, here's what happened. When I came back to Ireland in 1995 as a lecturer in mechanical engineering, I came back with all this ambition because I picked it up from Rick Hauschkes. And I said, right, we're going to set up a big international research lab here. And we're going to make a worldwide impact with our research. And at that time, we were just coming into the boom, the Celtic Tiger. There was money starting to come into Irish science. I got a very big grant from the European Union at the time, which Rick Hauschkes helped me to get. Mm. So we were immediately able to set up a very significant biomedical research facility into the area of bioengineering and medical devices. and we got going quickly. And then Science Foundation Ireland came along, and we applied for money there and got more funding, more European Union funding as well. And the whole thing expanded. And then PRTLI, which is the Programme for Research in Third Level Institutions, came along with philanthropic funding, which really catapulted Irish science into the onto the international stage. And I was fortunate to be able to be part of that in Trinity College.
You must be very proud then of having that legacy.
I am, yeah. It's going well. And there are many others taking on that responsibility now and working again with international collaborators in bioengineering and medical devices. Not just in Trinity, but in other universities in Ireland as well.
So it must be very important to have that international network.
It's very important. I think we sometimes forget how far we've travelled over the since the early 1990s. Irish science and scholarship, research and scholarship in general, has moved on greatly. And we've got to ensure that even now when we're in austerity and funding is tight, that we don't lose the great gains that we've made over the last 10 to 15 years in science and in research. Because that's where the future is. That's where the future high-quality jobs are. We've got to continue to invest in research and in science to create and develop the knowledge economy that are going to give the high-quality jobs to our young people in the future. We can't slip back. We can't go back to being what we were in the 1980s. We have to continue to invest and grow our research and technology infrastructure.
Paddy, you're a Wexford man. Can you tell me a little bit about your family?
Well, I'm the eldest of six. I have four brothers and one sister. My father had a haulage business. He owned lorries and drew beet, as we would say, for local farmers, and did work like that, and had sheds for storage. And growing beet was a profitable activity for many farmers. There was a big sugar factory in Carlow that my father drew beet to. And then he was involved in distribution for shops and supermarkets as well.
And were you ever interested in taking over the business?
Not really, actually. Though I think I got my interest in machinery and engineering from being at home. But I think my parents had me earmarked at an early stage to go to university, and that one of my younger brothers would take over the business.
Well, they were obviously, you know, very aware of education and very committed to education of their children.
Well, my mother did quite well, and she became a nurse, a registered nurse, and did very well working as a nurse in Dublin before she got married and then moved back down to Wexford because she was originally from Enniscorthy. My father didn't have much by way of education himself. He went to the local tech, the very same tech that my brothers had gone to, mm-hmm. in Kilmuckridge. But I think when I got of secondary school going age, they had decided that they would do the best and send me to St. Peter's College, Wexford.
You were a boarder there, is that right?
There's no boarding there anymore, but when I was young, there was. And I came in from my home parish of Owlert, only about 15 miles away, but I boarded in St. Peter's College, Wexford for 5 years.
And was it difficult to leave home at the age of 12 to go to be a boarder?
I suppose it was. I mean, you're taken out of your family environment and put into this rather strange institutional environment run by priests.
Mm.
It is, I think, difficult. I wouldn't want it for my own children.
Mm-hmm. And, was it lonely?
It's not lonely exactly, but you're taken away, I suppose, from your parents, your father and mother, and mothers in particular, because mothers always loom very large in Irish lives in those times. Fathers were often out working. But mm-hmm. you're taken away from your family home environment and put in this different environment. It's not exactly lonely, because there are plenty of people, plenty of boys your own age. So, no, I wouldn't say lonely, but boarding schools, I think, do tend to have an effect on people. You can spot people who've been to boarding schools.
How can you spot them? Tell me.
Well, I remember being out, maybe a few years ago with some colleagues of mine. You go to these very good dinners sometimes when you're a provost, and all the dinners were put down in front of people. And, I got my dinner, but I looked at the guy next to me to see that he get more than me. and he looked at me. And other people around the table said, "What's going on here?" And it turns out we two had been to boarding school. So... there are little giveaway signs. I think boarding schools for boys or for girls, they may have been necessary one time, but and for some families maybe still are necessary. But I think that it is a kind of an artificial and strange environment for a young person to be brought up in.
Does it make a difference, do you think, with your family, your parents, that you're away?
Oh, it certainly does, sure. They don't know what you're doing, really, and you're not talking to them at the end of every day like you would be where you're living with them. But I have no real reference point for it, I suppose, because I went to a boarding school. But I see now with my own kids that I probably would know more about what they're doing in school, generally speaking, than my parents would have. And I think that's because I was in a boarding school.
Mm-hmm. So it's good to maintain that contact.
Well, I mean, someone said to me once, you have to talk about the ordinary basic things before you can talk about the very important things in life. So if you don't talk about those routine and basic things, when it comes to the really serious issues, you've no way to get to them.
Paddy, your late father died when you were only 20 years old, but what do you think he'd make of you as head of Trinity College Dublin now?
Well, I'd like to think he'd be proud, and I think he would be proud, and that's what my mother tells me now anyway, that he would be, and I think it's true. But he was a man of his own ambitions as well. He probably wouldn't have said that he was proud. He probably would have said that had he got the same opportunities, he would have been provost in his day. And that may have also been true.
And your mother, is she enjoying your role as provost?
I think she absolutely loves it, frankly. She was there on the day of the election, as were all my family members in Front Square when the announcement was made that I was elected provost.
They were waiting outside?
Outside at the end of the dining hall steps, and were overjoyed and partied for weeks on the news. Now she's moved, actually, and she's up every weekend, most weekends, living in number 1 Grafton Street. She has her own room there, and she's well ensconced, and I'm happy to have her. And she's a great help to us with managing the house and looking after the kids.
And Paddy, you've returned to the smaller schools in Wexford as provost. Do you think that's important to do?
I do. It was a particular pleasure recently to go down to St. Peter's College, Wexford, to do the prize giving there for the final year students. But the year before that, I'd been back to my old primary school in Owlert. They were raising the green flag and I was the person that they invited to do that. And I enjoyed that greatly, having tea and buns and talking to the teachers afterwards. But I think it's also important, not just for the pupils in the school, but the whole parish and the parents as well, to know that I value my connections with my home parish of Owlert. And I think that the education I got in Owlert National School, as it was then called, that school set me off on the road that led me to where I am today.
And Paddy, is there any advice that you can give to students who are waiting for their Leaving Cert results? Because they'll be opening those envelopes. It'll be a very tense and emotional day. But what about those who are disappointed, who maybe don't achieve at the points that they've been looking for?
I think the main thing is to know that there are many opportunities that present themselves in life. And you may have in your mind a particular path and particular course, and you might not get your first choice, so to speak, but there are many good choices and many good avenues to be taken in life. It's how you react to the challenges that are faced on the multiple issues that face you in life. That's what's important. And it would be absolutely the wrong thing to open the envelope and, oh, if you didn't get your first choice, think that this was a doomsday scenario. Be positive and face the challenges of life openly, and you will succeed.
And how about you facing your own challenges? You've 8 years left as the provost of Trinity. What would you like to say that you've achieved when the moving van pulls off from number 1 Grafton Street in 8 years' time?
I want, like my predecessors have done, to leave the university in a strong position, in a position where it's offering the very best of education. Over a 10-year period, Trinity College will graduate maybe 20 or 30,000 students. And I can have an influence on the education that they've received and to make sure that it's as good as it can possibly be. I would like also to have robustly faced the financial challenges that the university has, because I firmly believe we cannot have a top-tier international quality university on the kind of financial footing that it's set on at the moment. We have to find a way around this. We have to, I think, agree almost as a country of what we want for our young people. And it's a key job of the Provost of Trinity College, as indeed for other leaders of other universities and higher education institutions, to argue for the value of investing in higher education. It is the way to give our young people the best chance in life. And if we can all understand that, universities, politicians, funders of various kinds, then I think I'll have done my job well.
And our last piece of music from your very eclectic selection this morning is from Tom Waits, and it's called Diamonds on My Windshield. Why have you chosen this song?
This song invokes in me something about travelling, particularly travelling in a car. You know, we do a lot of our thinking as we drive around in cars. And obviously so does Tom Waits.
Well, Paddy Prendergast, Provost of Trinity College, thank you very much for being my guest this week on Evening in Company. Thank you very much for listening at home. Bimmy Liv, Eganam Kane and Shachtan Shahugan. On sound today is Peter Cheevers. Ger Philpott researched, and this programme was produced by Eileen Hearn. This is Tom Waits and Diamonds on My Windshield.
And the diamonds on my windshield and these tears from heaven. Well, I'm pulling into town on the interstate. I got me a steel train in the rain, and the wind bites my cheek to the wing. Late nights, freeway flying, always makes me sing. It always makes me sing.
Evening and Company on RTE Radio 1. Podcast the show at rte.ie/radio player.